Saga Egmont presents The Oyster Keys Murders by Pauline Rowson. Read by Andrew Scarborough. Chapter 1. Monday. The wailing police siren sliced through the rain-washed night. Horton quickly checked the mirrors of his Harley and dropped his speed. But the police car sped past him on the motorway, heading towards Portsmouth city centre, with its blue light pulsating like a homing beam for a lost alien. Swiftly, he calculated the time. It had been 8 p.m. when he'd been ejected from the London School of Economics reading room because it was closing. And it had been just after 9:30 when he'd left the nearby pub after a meal and two Diet Cokes, which was an hour away from London, say. The roads were relatively traffic-free, so it must be sometime between 10:30 and 11 p.m. at the latest. About right for the drunks to start rolling out of the pubs looking for trouble. It wasn't his concern. He was off duty until tomorrow morning, when he'd probably return to find his desk in CID buckling under the weight of his 6-day absence. It hadn't been much of a holiday, he thought despondently, as he negotiated the roundabouts into the city centre. The one day he'd spent with his daughter had been the highlight of it, and even that had been tainted by the fact that Catherine, his estranged wife, had promised him too, but had yet again found an excuse to whisk Emma away. God only knew when he'd get to see her again. He pulled up at the traffic lights, trying not to feel disgruntled and frustrated. He'd spent the day searching an archive file for a clue as to the identity of 6 men in a photograph that he believed were somehow connected with the disappearance of his mother just over 30 years ago, which hadn't helped to lighten his mood. His research had yielded nothing except stiff shoulders and bleary eyes. Maybe he was looking in the wrong place. He'd been convinced, however, that the date of the reverse of the picture, written in black ink, 13th of March 1967, was linked to the sit-in protest by students at the London School of Economics. There was nothing else significant about that day that he could find, but perhaps the date meant nothing. The photograph could have been taken anywhere. There was also nothing to indicate its location, no slogans, no buildings or scenery, just 6 men sitting on the floor, their arms linked around one another with a small group of people in the background. Even the clothes provided no clues as to the whereabouts and the occasion of the black and white snapshot, except that the men were wearing the fashions of the late 1960s and their haircuts and, in 2 cases, beards bore that out. He squinted through the rain of his visor, watching the police vehicle stop at the end of the road in front of the Hard. They had probably been called to a fight at one of the pubs there. He should go home, but as the lights changed, he found himself swinging right instead of heading straight ahead home to his boat. He must be mad. The days when he needed to restrain drunken fighting yobs were over, but he found himself rather relishing the prospect of getting stuck in. He needed a distraction from his maudlin thoughts, and he needed activity to release some of the frustration he felt over yet another day wasted in the search for the truth behind his mother's disappearance. It was with a sense of disappointment, then, that he pulled in behind the police vehicle straddling the closed double wooden doors of the historic dockyard and silenced the Harley. There was no fight and no drunks. Just PCs Bailey and Johnson talking to 2 security guards at the side gate. Removing his helmet, Horton asked what was going on. "Suspicious death, sir," Johnson answered. "Inside?" Horton asked, troubled, as he dismounted. The younger and stouter of the 2 security officers answered him. "We think it's Dr. Douglas Spaulding. He gave a public lecture here tonight, and he hasn't signed out." Horton caught the brief exchange of glances between him and his colleague, a man in his mid-50s, lean with a haggard face and nervous manner. It didn't take a mind reader to see that someone had made a bull's up. "He's in number 1, Doc," the younger of the 2 security officers continued. That meant nothing to Horton, except that docks were very deep and sometimes full of water. Or was that a basin? Perhaps they were one and the same thing. "He's in the water?" he asked, suppressing a shiver, as he visualized the body floating face down in a dark, icy pool of stagnant water. He'd wished for action, but not this kind. He hadn't wanted anyone dead. "No, it's a dry dock, the last one at the end of the historic dockyard before you hit Portsmouth Harbour." Horton wasn't sure that conjured up a better picture. "You can confirm that he is dead." A worried expression crossed the security officer's round face.